Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. And I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman, and Dr. Kate. And for some reason, Blog Talk is playing an advertisement in my ear, so hopefully that'll stop in just a moment. I'd like to open up the show tonight before I introduce our guest with a prayer, as we usually do. Red, are you on with me yet? Well, Red will be with us shortly, I'm sure, and let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father in heaven, we just thank you so much for all the ways that you've blessed us, especially here at Walls in Our Minds, and we're especially thankful this night that we've got such a great lineup of guests for this panel of folks from the Sherman Institute, and we lift up them and that educational institution to you, that you might bless them and multiply their efforts and help people to be aware of them, because they are such a blessing to all of us. And Father, we ask that your Spirit be with us tonight. We just we want to be in your will. We know that we really can't accomplish anything of value unless you're going before us in this battle. We know that this is a spiritual battle, and we acknowledge you as the creator and the one that sustains us and the one that will bring increase in people who are of like minds. And we just we need you, and we acknowledge our need for you. We especially thank you for your son, Yeshua HaMashiach. We pray in his name. Amen. Well, who do I have on live with me is the question. Has anybody got a live mic and can say hello?
This is Aaron.
Good evening, Aaron.
I made it.
I'm glad you did. This is Aaron Bollinger, who has been on with us before here at Walls in Our Minds. He is one of the co-founders of the Sherman Institute, and he's also an instructor in political science and theology. And Aaron, we're just really grateful that you've helped put this panel together tonight. And maybe you could start out by giving just a little bit of background to the listeners that may be on that did not get your bio that I sent out earlier. If you could give them just a little bit of an idea of what you're about and what you're up to, it would be great.
Well, more about what I'm up to than who I am. I'm sure I have a face that was made for radio, and I would prefer, you know, not to talk so much about myself, but what a lot of good folks are doing to be put in with Sherman Institute. The very name Sherman Institute, I've had some folks in the South ask me where that came from. No, it's not William Tecumseh Sherman. It's Roger Sherman. And for those who don't know Roger, he was the only American to sign all four original founding documents, the Articles of Association, the Articles of Confederation, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution itself. He was well known in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, helped draft it, some of the key language within it. Was by his mind, and when we read from the notes, there's a book out there if anybody ever has a chance to pick it up. In fact, it's real simple to get. You can go up to archive.org and do a search for documents illustrative of the formation of the Union of American States. It's kind of the truncated version of the history of our country. But in there, you'll find the notes of Major William Pierce of Georgia, who was in the convention. And here's just a little clip of what he had to say about the people, the characters of the convention, and particularly Mr. Roger Sherman. He says, "Mr. Sherman exhibits the oddest-shaped character I ever remember to have met with. He is awkward, unmeaning, and unaccountably strange in his manner. But in his train of thinking, there's something regular, deep, and comprehensive. Yet the oddity of his address, the vulgarisms that accompany his public speaking, and that strange New England cant which runs through his public as well as his private speaking make everything connected with him grotesque and laughable. Yet he deserves infinite praise. No man has a better heart or a clearer head. If he cannot embellish, he'll furnish thoughts that are wise and useful." And it goes on and talks about him a little bit more, but he was 60 when he attended that convention. He was at one time the treasurer of Yale. He started out as a shoemaker, then got into doing almanacs, eventually became a lawyer and then a judge. He was respected for his theological understanding, his political science, and it just seemed like every time there was a problem going on in that original convention, Roger Sherman come up with things that led to what we might now think of as the Great Compromise, where the states got representation based on their size, but each state got two senators, so there was a check and balance built in. Quite a man. So when we started building Sherman Institute as a higher learning facility, I couldn't think of anybody who's been more ignored and yet deserves some recognition for the character, the kind of person, the trustworthiness and everything that he had. And there's some big shoes to try to fill in building an institution. But that's what we're working on. And we've got some really good people that are going to be on the show with us tonight that are part of that, both in the realm of students and instructors. Dr. Whitney, Pastor Whitney, Doctor of Divinity, he's finishing a course teaching right now, so he'll be joining us a little bit later on. Dr. Karen Roof, an artful master of the Queen's English, as it were, got her doctorate in rhetoric and composition. If anybody can tell you what something in the Constitution means based on the way the words are ordered and sorted and what they meant at the time the Constitution was drafted, she'll draw you a roadmap and show you what prepositional phrase modifies the subject and what verb is the action word. And a couple of our students are going to be with us tonight, one of whom is a baccalaureate candidate working with us in various courses and great A student, and one of our new students, Sharon Neff, will be with us, who's been studying advanced parliamentary procedure. And of course, when we talk about constitutional conventions, the first thing any convention does is draft and write its rules. So we've got students studying the rules process of politics and lots of cool things for us tonight to talk about.
Are you? What area code are you calling in from, Mary?
I'm in 814.
Okay. We also have an 816 area code that is now live, and also 951. And somebody else is on Skype. And also Red Beckman, if you'd like to say hello to Red. Aaron, he is on live with us now. Red, would you like to tell Aaron good evening?
I'll say good evening and welcome to the show, because we're looking forward to this show with great anticipation. I was a little late getting on because my phone has been just absolutely swamped all day. So my wife was on the phone to a daughter and in Minnesota, and I had to get her off to be able to get on here, because I've only got one line here, so I'm just glad to be here.
I'm very glad to be in your presence, sir. I was telling Terry earlier today, you know, a lot of Christians have the notion in their head you know, when they're judging how they ought to behave, they'll think, well, what would Jesus do? And I have a word for all these politicians out there. If they ever have something come up in front of them in their state capital, I would challenge them to think, what would Red Beckman do?
Oh, boy.
I've been reading your material for a long time. You're a great patriot and always an honor to be around you.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it's been a great life. The first half of my life, I was a CAT scanner and a truck driver and a sawmiller and a few other things. And there was a lot of work there and a lot of excitement. But when the IRS recruited me into what I spent the rest of my life with, I'm not looking back at the first part as being the best. It's been the last part of it that has been by far the best because of what has happened. And, you know, I tell people I made myself available, and boy, I went all over the country and never planned on anything like that because I liked the state of Montana well enough to spend my life there. But anyway, it's good to be here, and I'm glad we're having this program tonight.
Well, anybody that hasn't seen him yet, if you ever get the opportunity, grab Born Again Republic or Do Unto the IRS or The Church Deceived. Any of those three by Mr. Beckman are really good little short reads. The Father reveals things to people that diligently seek him, and he's definitely revealed some stuff to you, and freely it was given, freely you give, and I would suggest everybody grab those books and read them. You'll definitely get something out of them.
Well, do we have Dr. Karen Roof on with us yet?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, Karen, it's good to get reacquainted with you. I hope that you remember me from the Continental Congress 2009. You might have even met Red Beckman there, did you? I don't know.
I don't recall, but who am I speaking with?
This is Terry Dodd.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do remember you. Certainly do. I don't know if I had actually met Mr. Beckman in person or not, but I certainly remember you.
Well, it was a pleasure getting to know you, or at least getting meeting you a little bit there. Gained a little bit of respect for you and realized that you are a substantial person, and it's good to get reacquainted. So I'm really glad to have you on Walls in Our Minds tonight.
Terry?
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Terry? This is
yes.
Keith Broders with the Constitution Club. We've been on some calls with Mary Heiler and Michael Badnarik and some of those folks, I believe.
Yes.
I just want to make one comment about tonight's topic, and I think that this is something that is extremely important. I think everybody is familiar with what the Article 5 says. And basically,
they may not be, so that's one of the things we're going to cover tonight. So.
The one thing that I just want to mention is the fact is that I think most people would agree that when 34 states have requested a convention, that it is the constitutional duty of Congress to call the convention once two-thirds of the states have requested a convention. And frankly, whether or not the convention is a good idea or a bad idea, to me, is not the question. The question is, have 34 states asked for a convention or not? If they have, then the discussion is over, and there's no need to even discuss whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. If the number of the states needed has been met, the discussion is over. Now the next question is, what can we do to guarantee that the convention will not be co-opted and will not be a problem? Would you agree with that?
Well, there's more to that discussion than that, because there's been a bunch of states who have, in fact, rescinded their call. And as I said, we need to get into that, and I need to let the panel discuss that and explain what information they want to bring forward on this, and we'll get into that discussion. But thanks for calling in, Keith. We really didn't want to have the phone lines open until after the first hour of the show and give the panel a chance to do their thing. So I'll come back to you, Aaron. Thanks, Keith. Aaron, that's a good place to start. Now that and you might want to just give a little introduction on Karen, Aaron.
Well, Dr. Roof has been with us for a good while. I think her and I actually met. I gave a little presentation at one point to a 912 group down in South Carolina, and she was among the audience. And when we started talking about putting Sherman Institute together, she said, "Do you need somebody with a doctor's in English?" I'm like, "What, are you kidding? Of course we need somebody with a doctor's in English." So her and I have been working diligently together. I don't think there's a week that goes by that we don't have at least two or three phone calls, sometimes one a day when things are happening. But together she's been working with the rest of our team and building courses for various programs, helping build the programs themselves. She's rolled out probably 40 courses within the last year that can be applied to a master's in rhetoric composition and verbal expression that she designed. Sometimes her and I tag team on some of the lower level English courses. I'm not a master's in the Queen's English the way she is, so I let her handle anything in the 200 or above category, and she's even with me on the 100 and 200 level courses because she knows her stuff. And that's been an excellent relationship between her and I and the other members of the team, and I'm always glad to have her on a show with us.
Are your students on with us yet, do you know?
Well, Sharon or Alan?
Sharon's here.
Cool.
Hi. Good to be here.
Sharon has been taking our parliamentary procedure, advanced parliamentary procedure course this past semester.
If I may ask for the benefit of our producer that's on the switchboard, what area code are you calling from, Sharon?
816.
816. And how about Karen? Karen, what area code are you calling from?
864.
Thank you very much. Well, if we don't have any objections, I'd like to launch right into this panel discussion. Anything else you want to cover before we start?
Oh, Alan, have you joined the call yet? I know he's got a young child. He's probably trying to get put down before he gets on, but he may be here. We'll say that's a no for the moment, but he'll probably be joining us momentarily.
Well, I think Keith may be launched right into where we need to start, and that is to kind of give the folks a little bit of a description. I think some people have at least some knowledge of what a constitutional convention is, but not really probably a complete knowledge, or do they understand the real purpose of it and exactly how it would come together. So perhaps if somebody could launch out into just giving us a brief description of what an Article 5 constitutional convention is and how it comes into being.
Well, that's fairly simple. Article 5 states, there is provision in the Constitution for amendment. As we know, the first Constitution's draft didn't get approved exactly as it was. The state said, we want a Bill of Rights, and we want to make sure that certain things are covered. So, those amendments, the first 10 that we have, became something of a condition before many states would even agree to ratify it. So there's two methods built into the Constitution for change. One is that a member of Congress, either House, can propose an amendment, and if all of Congress agrees to it, then they ship it back to the states for ratification. The second provision is that if the legislatures of the states call for a convention, just like the original one that was held or thereabouts, then as Mr. Broders correctly noted, when three or two-thirds of the states, which with 50, that means 34, do the math, when 34 states petition Congress for a convention, they have no choice. There is it's a mandate that a convention be called. And Congress is supposed to, you know, send out the notice that the convention is going to begin whenever and wherever. They may choose to say delegates meet here, and you know, it's basically up to the convention then to propose amendments. The word in the Constitution is amendments. It's plural. You know, there's nothing in the Constitution that allows Congress to constrain a convention to any single issue or any group of issues. If the petitions say we'd like to consider a balanced budget amendment and term limits and something else, you know, that's what the calls request, but, you know, states that don't call are still going to be invited, and they may have other ideas. So there's really nothing that can limit a state or any group of states to constraining their thoughts to any one or two or whatever number of amendments. Now, as Mr. Broder's noted, there's been a lot of calls for conventions over the years. Some of them date back still to the 1700s. You know, at what point does a call for a convention expire? There's nothing in the Constitution that says so, that even addresses that. What if a bunch of states call for a balanced budget amendment? Maybe let's just pick a number out of the sky, like 32, and then two states have called for something else. Should Congress call a convention because 34 states have said, let's do a convention, we got this idea, you got that idea? I don't think there's any question that Congress can't constrain the convention any topic or topics. So, you know, the constitutional process is set into motion, the constitutional revision process. So that's, you know, if you count, it depends how you count, where you begin counting from, and some states may have called for two or three conventions, and some, as we've noted, have actually rescinded their earlier calls for conventions, deciding, well, maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, we don't want one. You know, the Constitution's unspecific. Should Congress even take the word of a state that rescinds or backs out? I like Marshall Peters about 20 years ago taught me this little one-liner. You know, if you say you're going to a convention for the single and exclusive purpose of proposing a balanced budget amendment, it's kind of like telling your wife you're going to the ballpark for the specific and exclusive purpose of buying a hot dog. If the ball game breaks out, you're leaving. Well, the ball game breaks out, you leave. So what? The game goes on. If we look at history and see the first convention that took place, we see some delegates there that realized they were going above and beyond what their states authorized them to do, and they left. What happened? Convention went on without their input. So this is a door that once it gets opened, ain't shut until the event's over. And whatever comes out of it then has to be ratified. Now, how's it to be ratified? Article 5 specifies that as well. It says Congress can decide. So it could be sent back to the legislatures of the states, just like the typical process. It could also be sent to ratifying conventions. You know, the Constitution is ambiguous enough to give Congress, who is the problem, or at least a large part of the problem, control over some of the rules to the game. So is this something we really want to have happen in the current state of affairs in this country? And I think most people would agree that there's not enough James Madisons and Roger Shermans running around to guarantee the integrity, something coming out of a modern convention. So that's where we're at right now. And there's a group calling themselves Citizens for Self-Governance, consists of one of the original founders of the Tea Party Patriots movement, is one of the founders of this group, that's running around trying to get states to introduce calls for a convention into this 2014 state assembly session we see coming up about the second week of January. And, you know, first of the year, probably 35 or so states will convene somewhere between the first and the 25th of the month. So you could see these resolutions start popping up in states all over the place. We want a convention for this, that, and the other. And, of course, we at Sherman Institute have a copy of their documents, so we're not pulling this stuff out of the sky. We know exactly what they're suggesting the convention do, and and all of the history of this thing as to what we have to look back over the years and see what, you know, what can happen at a convention. And that's why we're here, to talk about it. We think that the debate is good. People need to know the truth about this. You know, can a convention be limited? And who will be the delegates? And how will it be ratified? Can it be constrained? All those kind of things.
Well, we are in a very precarious political environment in recent decades, I would go so far as to say. Really, we've been in a precarious political environment for well over 150 years, but recently that situation seems to have escalated and a lot more Marxist, fascist type of things going on. And I think it's not even debatable. It's known as a fact that a lot of the people in top positions and even our state legislatures and our governors have been installed by the people who control the purse strings, the banksters, have had a tremendous amount of influence. These are the very people who are pushing what's known as the One World Order, or the New World Order, as they call it. And it's been a great concern of mine that who the delegates would be that would be going to such a convention. And so what are the rules? How are the delegates selected? I mean, is there an election by people? I've never seen anything that indicated that. So can you share a little bit about what you know, if you know, exactly how those delegates would be selected?
Well, all we have to go by is Article 5. Congress is supposed to call the convention. So, you know, apparently the wisdom of the Founding Fathers was that if the states petition for a convention, Congress will call it and determine such things. As far as wisdom of our current Congress, I'm not sure that too many people would want to trust their mode of doing things. And whatever it would be, I think it's pretty clear that Dr. Roof and Dr. Whitney and myself and, you know, John Rowland and, you know, people of that caliber who might have a real good idea of what would actually work to fix things, if anything can be proposed to fix things, won't be getting the gilded invitations to this event. And that's all we've got to go on. The Constitution is deliberately ambiguous because, you know, they figured that when the states called, Congress would call the event, and, you know, hopefully there'd be enough people around with some wisdom to make it happen. Now, you know, we talk about the current state of America. In 1788, I mean, this is not long after the original convention, James Madison wrote a letter to George Turberville, and he said, having witnessed the difficulties and dangers experienced by the first convention, which assembled under every propitious circumstance, I'll let it to the listener to look up propitious. He said, I should tremble for the result of a second, meeting in the present temper of America and under all the disadvantages I have mentioned. You know, it's fairly long letter, but that's the operative quote. You know, when you've got money out there, and, of course, the original Constitution included a provision that, you know, everything that was a debt entered into by the first Articles of Confederation government would be equally still applicable in this case. Well, now we've got people calling for a convention to balance the budget. Heaven help us if they would try to balance this current debt on the backs of the people. But just assuming that all was good, if you're a bondholder and you own a U.S. Treasury bond in another country, for example, you're going to say, wait a minute, constitutional convention, balanced budget, these people could renege on this debt. I want to cash this thing in. You know, multiply that. Now, you know, the dangers that Madison were speaking of, a lot of that was related to debt. How much more debt does this country have today than it did at that point? Would it be more dangerous now to have that situation present itself than even, you know, at a year or two after the first convention. You know, this is serious stuff. We're playing with fire here. You know, a lot of folks would like to see this economic system just go ahead and collapse and get it over with. Open a convention and watch how it happens.
Well, how are the rules of such a convention set? You guys teach classes on parliamentary procedure. I would assume that the rules are really not set until the convention comes together and approves those rules. Is that correct?
Well, as we see, and anybody who studies state government, for example, and anybody who studies Congress can look. You know, go to your state website and just type in S-Res 1 or House Res 1. As soon as a session convenes of a sovereign assembly of any type, their first order of business is adopting the rules of their session. They don't necessarily adopt the same rules that were existent in the previous session. They're a new sovereign assembly. A new election has taken place. So these people adopt their own rules. And if you look in the notes of James Madison, when the first Constitutional Convention convened, their first order of business was adopting their rules. Are they going to use Mason's manual? Are they going to use Jefferson's manual? Are they going to write their own rules? All these things have to be considered by the convention because they are a sovereign entity. They are sovereign above Congress. Congress can only call them. Congress can't tell them what to do. You know, they may look at the existing rules of the assembly in the U.S. House and say, we're just going to adopt the U.S. House rules as our business. They may have other agendas. And, of course, any sovereign assembly even has the right, and you see it all the time, Congress votes to suspend the rules so they can do something that the rules don't even provide for or that they, you know, that a motion would be out of order under normal procedures. All of those things, believe me, the folks who are part of this convention, if it happens, are going to be savvy with rules. And the most savvy of the rules players are going to be the ones that control what takes place. It's entirely up to the convention to set their own rules.
Well, as we know right now, even in our Senate and House of Representatives, a very large percentage of those elected officials are, in fact, attorneys, which stands in direct conflict with the original 13th Amendment. And if we end up with that type of environment, which we most likely would, in the delegates of this convention, I see this Katie bar the door, really. I think what I would like to do at this point, just to maybe give an opportunity for each one of our panel members to get their voice in here a little bit, I'd kind of like to let each one of them take, you know, 3-4 minutes, whatever, and tell us what their sentiments are regarding a constitutional convention and perhaps express their top concern or two for a constitutional convention. That sound good, Aaron?
Yeah, that's fine. Dr. Roof, have at it.
Well, I'm going to take off on one comment that you made, Aaron, about the rules, because we have just had that illustrated today. 200 years of precedence has been changed by Harry Reid, who decided to approve presidential appointees with only 51 votes, which basically eliminates the filibuster. Now, if he can simply do that on a whim, and back when Republicans were in held the offices, that subject came up and the Democrats were just horribly opposed to it. And now all of a sudden it's okay. So if they can change the rules just to get their way, who knows what rules would be part of an Article 5 convention. The other thing, I have been rereading Thomas Wood's book on nullification. I'm not going to get into that, but one of the things that he points out that really jumps out at me with this whole issue is that I don't think anybody would disagree with the concept that the states considered themselves sovereign entities.
and that the Constitution very clearly states that, you know, those responsibilities not enumerated to the federal government belong to the states and to the people. I don't believe anybody would disagree with that.
Karen,
well,
can I hate, I don't want to interject, but I need to. We're getting a lot of background noise. If you are not speaking, please mute yourself, because we're getting breathing sounds and rustling sounds, and it's kind of interrupting the speaker.
How
please
do we mute
ahead,
ourselves?
If you have a mute button, if you're calling in on Skype, there's a mute button on your screen. If your most phones have a mute button as well. We can mute you on this end, but not knowing exactly which area codes might need to be muted is a challenge. Go ahead.
Is there like a star six or something like that, or?
No, not on this. We have a mute button on our switchboard, but it's challenging when you have this many people to know which ones need to be muted and when to unmute them. It's easier for the person to mute themselves if they can. It sounds like it's quieted down quite a bit. Karen, please go ahead. I'm sorry I had to interrupt.
Oh, that's okay. It always occurs to me that two groups of people are always excited about the possibility of pushing for an Article 5 convention. The one group consists of people who somehow think that the Constitution is flawed and that they could use an Article 5 convention to fix it. The other group are people who want an Article 5 convention because they anticipate totally doing away with it and coming up with a brand new Constitution, which would totally remake our country. Either approach is not a good thing. As far as fixing the Constitution, and I hear that frequently that, well, we should add this amendment or that amendment. Okay, well, it wouldn't be a bad idea, and I'm referring back to Thomas Woods here. I kind of agree with him that to add an amendment that reasserts that the states are sovereign and that if a responsibility is not specifically delegated to the federal government, it flat out does not belong to them, and that's simply the end of the story. That might be something that would need to be clarified. Even Jefferson and some of those were concerned over the abuse of various clauses of the Constitution, which they never anticipated that they would be abused, but they have been. So, you know, but I don't see that we would solve anything. However, my position is, and always has been, and I actually have to go back to Continental Congress, which was really the awakening of my life when I was at that event in Illinois. But one of the things that really just stuck in my poor brain is that before we try to fix, add to, change, do away with, or whatever they think they might want to do with the Constitution, we need to get back to following it. There are so many areas, it's like we've already trashed it. The federal government even admits that almost nothing they do has anything to do with the Constitution. In fact, I have to, I don't have a whole lot of love for Clyburn down here in South Carolina, but I do have to credit him for being honest. When asked if, you know, Obamacare was constitutional, he made the comment, "Nothing we do has anything to do with the Constitution." Well, that is too true. And if we started looking at ways to hold our current politicians to the Constitution, making them answer for their behavior, I don't think we need to do very much to the Constitution other than maybe a couple of clarification amendments. The document is the most beautiful governing document ever written in the history of the world. And to take a chance on coming out with something that would be totally different, I think would be a disaster. Just for example, and then I'll switch to let you go to somebody else. Do you think for one second that we would come out of a constitutional convention with a statement saying that, that anything not delegated to the federal government belongs to the states, you know, asserting state sovereignty? Do you think for one second that we would still have the statement, "Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion or the or the practice thereof. I'm not, you know, reading my constitution there at the moment or prohibiting the exercise thereof. But do you really think that we would be able to save those amendments and still have the freedoms that we have when the agenda of the powers that are basically running the world right now is to get towards a massive global governance? There is just way too much at stake, and we would never get it back. I think it would shatter the country. There are states that would not ratify something that sacrificed our freedoms, and then it would, you know, what would their choice be, to try to secede again? It would just be an absolute disaster.
Well spoken, Dr. Roof.
Very well.
Sharon, you've been participating in our parliamentary procedure course, and one of the things that that you got to do was touch and hold James Madison's notes. What kind of things, just, you know, generally, without getting too specific, but what things generally did you find interesting with respect to the first convention that took place in our nation's history, the only that we've really had?
Well, generally, it was hard to do with James Madison's notes because there were 636 pages of them, and he was very specific and very attention to detail, and I take minutes of the class, of the advanced parliamentary procedure class. I take the minutes, and my minutes will never be like that, like his, but they were incredible men. That's the first thing that I think of when he wrote about them and wrote really their character and wrote about things, and we got kind of a look into their, you know, into their heart, and the document was just really like, wow, you know, you really kind of like you got to meet them. And that's what I, the thing I have to mainly say about it. They were incredible men, and enlightened, and what they did, what they gave us is just an incredible gift. And I don't know if people, you know, really realize that, Americans realize that, but this course is really, you know, I didn't know it to the extent that this course has helped me to see it, you know, to see it a little bit more than I did. So it's been really great. But I'm a student. I have more questions than answers. So when Aaron asked, you know, to me to be on the panel, I really have more questions than answers, but I did have a comment. I would like to comment on what Terry asked of us, though, if I could, because his statement was, I think, the crux of the issue here, and Terry said that, you know, can you call a convention, you know, to make the rules? I mean, can you make the rules before there's a call to convention? I think that was the question, right? And my comment about the whole thing is that they haven't called to convention, so they don't have the authority to discuss rules. And what they're doing December 7th at Mount Vernon is unconstitutional within itself. So it's just, you know,
Yeah, we haven't even touched on that one yet, but for those who's wondering, what's she talking about? Well, on December 7th of all days, Pearl Harbor Day, the Senate president for the state of Indiana has called a meeting of state legislators to go to Mount Vernon and adopt rules for a constitutional convention. Now, when I saw that, I'm thinking, like, who told him to do that? Well, nobody. But, of course, the Citizens for Self-Governance and the American Legislative Exchange Council and all these groups that have been pushing for this Article 5 convention would like to be able to say, here's the rules. We have the rules for the convention. And when we call this convention, this is what's going to happen. Now, that's a nice theory, but no one's told him to do it. He's certainly not a member of any convention that's been called yet. And, you know, the convention may very well take that set of rules and look at them and say, this is great, but, yeah, we don't like this, we don't like this, we're going to adopt our own. Or they may say, we like this, and then this one we're going to add about 15 more to it. You don't know what they're going to do. It's up to the convention to adopt their own rules, just as we've, you know, found out that states do all the time. And anybody else who, you know, has an assembly, the first thing you do is you adopt the rules. First thing we did in our parliamentary procedure course was what? We put a motion out on the floor to adopt the Roberts Rules of Order as the governing rules for the conduct of our classroom. Now, I could have chose Mason's Manual, or someone could have suggested something else. We could have used anyone we wanted to use. But that's how it works. An assembly sets its rules. And whatever he may be attempting to achieve, or perhaps just having something in his pocket that can help him convince people that the rules are written, that doesn't mean that those are the rules that are going to be used. So this is a dangerous, dangerous game we're playing. If the man's going to be honest with people and say, we're going to attempt to establish some rules that a convention could use, and remain so ambiguous, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the rules that come out of this mock meeting, whatever it is, they're going to go around and say, we have the rules for the convention, this is how it's going to operate, as though it's the gospel truth, and it may or may not be. Highly likely it's not going to be. But yeah, it's a noble thought on one hand to try to do something to constrain a convention, but he can't do it. And secondly, he doesn't have the authority. No one's told him to do it on behalf of the convention. So this is a real dangerous game being played in Mount Vernon. It's happening December the 7th, coming up here in just a matter of a couple of weeks. And who's being invited? I haven't seen the attendee list. All I know is that the Senate president for the state of Indiana is the one that's spearheading it. How are they paying these people to get to Mount Vernon? Who are they inviting? Which states will be involved? I haven't got any answers to those questions, but they need to be answered. By what authority are they trying to do this? I'd like to know.
Well, I was just trying to go back and look at some notes from a week or so ago. There was a fellow who was one of the board members for the group that you mentioned, that Citizens for Self-Governance, and I'm trying to pull that up. You know, Mark Levin, for example, came out with his book recently. Okay, this senior fellow for constitutional studies, head of convention of the states project, Michael Ferris, he is apparently tied in closely with a Grover G. Norquist, who is a key player for the Council on Foreign Relations. So the link there is made with the CFR, with the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, it's been known for some time that organization was put together again by the banksters, by the globalists, for the sole purpose of controlling the government and political scene for America. So we have to start asking questions like, you know, who are these people and who's pushing them and who's driving this this constitutional convention push and for what purpose?
And who's funding it? Yeah, that the big issue is funding, because, you know, the borrower is servant to the lender. So if somebody's putting money out whoever's being invited and having their bread buttered for these journeys around the country, you can bet there's an interest there that they're going to try to protect. Some very scary things taking place. Pastor Whitney, have you managed to tie in yet and join us?
Do you know what area code he'd be calling in from?
410, most likely. He's in Maryland.
How about Alan? What area code would he be calling in from?
Alan would be 501.
Yes, 501's got a live mic.
Okay. Alan, you with us?
Yes, sir. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Did you hear the question earlier, Alan?
I'm, again, a student at the Sherman Institute, and I just found this whole thing really fascinating. And, again, like Anna, more questions than answers, but it's been a fascinating road.
Well, let me give you that opportunity. We've got this panel here. You're familiar with these folks. What question would you like to see answered at this point? While you're thinking about that for a moment, the one question that I have is, what about the authority of this Constitutional Convention? I've been told and read, and from the looks of it, it's accurate that a Constitutional Convention carries more weight than a joint session of Congress. So it is more powerful than our Senate or our House of Representatives. And that makes it an even greater threat. And it's like you said before, Aaron, you referred to it as a sovereign assembly. And I think there's some who may take some exception with that. But at least on a relative basis, they are exercising at least some level of sovereignty with this. And maybe you could describe that a little bit more detail, Aaron, while Alan is thinking of what question he'd like to have you guys answer.
Well, how do we determine they're sovereign? I think the best way to put that is that Article 5 itself, being deliberately vague, giving them the power, I mean, they're a constitutional animal. A convention, remember, each of our branches of the federal government, Article 1, Congress, Article 2, Executive Branch, Article 3, Judiciary, Article 4, much to do about the states, some thou shalt not, because they've surrendered some power, so they are prohibited from doing X, Y, and Z in Article 4. And, of course, if you open the convention for general discussion about taking powers away from Congress or limiting their power and jurisdiction the way this convention calling resolution of CSG does, then you're necessarily going to have to take things out of Articles 1, 2, and 3 and put them back in 4, because you got to take it away from somebody and then give it back to where it goes. So Article 4 is the states. Article 5 is a convention. So apparently, at very least, just by the very structure of the Constitution, a convention is going to be a co-equal branch of government. At the national level, they're a constitutional entity. So that makes them powers that they have, which are pretty vague. In Article 5, there's nothing there to do but propose amendments. I mean, they could literally say, you know, we're going to start over. And they'd be completely within their authority, because they are a co-equal branch of government. Article 5 is a convention. Article 1 is Congress, 2, 3, 4, boom, right down the row. So at minimum, they're a federal entity with co-equal power to any of the other branches of government, can do whatever they want. And as a sovereign entity, you know, Congress goes in, sets their rules. You know, the Chief Justices of the Supreme Court and the people that are involved in the judiciary, they set the rules and procedure of the court. You know, the executive branch pretty well is supposed to at least from a constitutional standpoint, enforce the laws of the union that Congress gives them. So, you know, and the judiciary is supposed to be the branch that adjudicates anything under those things and does quite a few other things, of course. They've got original jurisdiction and matters between states and stuff like that. So, you know, here we go. It's a whole new constitutional animal. They're going to have to set up their own rules when they go into business, and they're going to have to do the business that the Constitution allows them to do, which is pretty wide open.
Alan, are you ready with your question?
I have a question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go right ahead.
That question. Is that okay, Alan?
Yes. Ladies first.
Well, you know, they can do whatever they want to, but in Article 5, they can't ratify anything unless they have 3/4, right, of the several states, of the states.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be so, because the convention is the Article 5 is ambiguous enough that any of two modes of ratification can be proposed for the convention's product. It can either go back to the states or it can go to conventions within the states. Remember,
so they can, in the rules, get rid of the ratification of the 3/4 of the states.
Well, look at what the original Articles of Confederation had in mind, and the people that sent the original convention to Philadelphia to meet said that anything that came out of that convention would have to be ratified by all of the states. Suddenly, the new Constitution changed its own ratification process.
Oh,
it said that the ratification of this document by any 9 states shall be sufficient, and then those states that ratify it will be operating under it. All the others will just be out on their own doing their own little sovereign thing. They were fine with that. So theoretically, the amendment process could be changed within the new document that comes from this convention.
Okay. I got it. Thank you.
I don't hear a lot of people talking about what it is in the Constitution that needs to be fixed, but they keep talking about the need of this constitutional convention and a need for amendments in order to fix it. But to me, I don't see that. I also don't see anything from stopping them from amending it through the other means of approving it through the legislatures, through the legislative branch, and then taking it for ratification to the states. It would appear to me that this balanced budget thing is nothing more than a ruse to try to convince people that that's a justified reason to hold a convention. I don't believe that they're seeking a balanced budget at all. I believe that they're just using that as an excuse to get the state legislatures to issue a call. And the other thing that interested me, Aaron, was when that happened in Colorado and I confronted my own congressman about it, he put me in touch directly with a legislative counsel, in other words, attorney that works for the state that advises the representatives and senators. And they were told that, oh, this is just really nothing more than a political statement, that it really won't have any effect. And so he put me in direct contact with him, and I point blank started asking him questions like, you know, tell me how you can specifically limit the scope of a constitutional convention, and show me the rules for that, show me the provisions for that in the Constitution that where you have the right to limit it. And of course, that and the other questions that I hit him with, you know, he had to admit to me that my concerns were legitimate and that he really couldn't argue with anything that I was telling him. And so then I turned around and asked my congressman, how is it that instead of seeking the will of your constituents, you went on the advice of an attorney who is not even elected to his office? And,
well,
and you made a decision on your vote.
when you go into a state capitol today, you know, there's provisions in the Constitution that deal with specific things. For example, no state can coin money. Okay, we'll just leave it at that. It's a little bit more involved. But, okay, there's a very real prohibition on the states. And the fact that that the states are mentioned in economics there with that type of a statement, but it also says, no state shall make anything other than gold and silver coin, a tender, and payment of debt. In fact, that's one of the things that Roger Sherman said. That was his one of his contributions was on the money power. And so there you've got states that are required to do something economically. Well, if you ask them a question about why they're not demanding gold and silver coin, they're going to give you one of three answers. I don't know, which is pretty typical, or I'm not an economics professor, so I would defer you to, you know, whoever. Or they would say, well, that's a federal question. Talk to your congressman, because they recognize that Congress has the power to deal with the money because the states are prohibited from it, except that thing, and they can't figure out how that works. They just don't know enough about the Constitution. So these states that are being, you know, legislators that are being talked into this, you know, it's pretty easy to convince people that went to the same public schools that we all did that, you know, this is a good thing. See, here we're limiting it where our language says it's going to be limited. In this case, they're saying three things. Now let's look at those three things that they're talking about doing. One is limiting the power and jurisdiction of the federal government. Okay, they didn't say they're going to limit the abuse of power by the executive branch, which is obviously the most glaring errors, these executive orders and all this stuff. No, they say they're going to limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government. Well, that opens Article 1, Article 2, and Article 3, and like I said, Article 4, because anything you take away from the federal government, be it jurisdiction or anything else, you got to give it back to the states in Article 4. So someone's going to have to do some pretty artful amending, some pretty artful language to accomplish even that little microcosm. But that's not limiting anything. That's just that language right there has opened the entire document to revision. Now, when they say they want to balance the budget, okay, great. Here's a good one for us. Let's balance the budget. Okay, Article 1, Congress is supposed to provide and maintain a Navy. Well, that's spending. Should we now no longer do that so that our ships can be hijacked by people in foreign countries and the people held for ransom, much like they were in our founding years when we were dealing with the Turks and the Barbary pirates? You know, that was one of the provisions, and one of the reasons for that provision was so that our commerce with other nations could flow and we'd have protection for our merchant vessels that were transporting goods and services to and from the United States. Now, you know, the power of taxation involved in imposts. You know, that's that water's edge stuff that no one wants to do. That's protectionism. We can't do that anymore. Well, there's a way that Congress could be raising money to help balance their books doing that. You know, they've switched away from that. How can we ever have a balanced budget if we're not going to collect some taxes? But then again, the direct taxation provisions of Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4 and Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 tie representation and direct taxes together. So now if suddenly they tinker with that and say we just want to give Congress a little bit more authority to tax, they're going to try to balance this massive budgets on our back by direct taxation. Well, they could certainly do that if these people don't know what they're doing with the language of the Constitution and they untie something from something else that's put there as a restriction on the government. You know, so if you're just talking about budget, that opens up, you know, 80% of the clauses of the Constitution. Because if it's a spending thing that Congress is authorized to do, you've either got to curtail the spending, hopefully, or you've got to increase taxes. Now, you can talk about direct taxes. You can talk about indirect. You can talk about inland excises, duties, impost excises, or the indirect forms of taxation. Somebody better know what they're doing, because they're going to have to come up with a plan to make money in equal money out. That's what a balanced budget means. I'd be happy to see a budget. How many years has it been since there's been a budget? It's been a series of continuing resolution after resolution to borrow more for this emergency, that emergency. Nothing to do with even putting it out on paper so we can see where the money's going. You know, there's no provision in the Constitution for secret black budgets and paramilitary operations and intelligence gathering agencies and assassinating foreign heads of state. Well, there's some spending going on. You know, it takes a little money to train Navy SEALs. Yeah, it takes a little money to do all these. What are we going to cut and what are we going to keep and how are we going to expand the revenue flow to make this wonderful budget we have come into this magical formula called balanced? I just want to see a budget. But we don't need to amend the Constitution to achieve that, do we? The provisions are there. Provisions are there for a balanced budget. In fact, if you look at the direct taxing power, that's what it was there for, to prevent borrowing. They would send a bill to the states based on their voting strength in Congress. Okay, we've had a war. We need to raise $100 million. We've had to borrow to meet our expenses. Maryland, you have 8 congressmen. Therefore, 8 435ths of the total amount of money we need, you got to pay for so we don't have to continue borrowing and funding a deficit year after year. We got to extinguish this debt in the year the money was spent. Well, there's the problem. They haven't done that since 1860s. For a simple reason. If they had to come back to their state and hand them a bill for their state's apportioned share of the deficit, what would the state legislators do? They'd say, wait a minute, what are you spending this money on? You can't do this. We didn't authorize this. So it would hold them accountable for the spending in the year the money is spent. The balanced budget amendment is already there. It's not an amendment. It's interwoven into Article 1, Section 8 and Article 1, Section 2. Okay, and Article 1, Section 9. And the 16th Amendment didn't touch that. Well, Mr. Beckman's on the call. I'll say, assuming the 16th Amendment was properly ratified, it still didn't change it. You know, the power of direct taxation is still there. But they know if they use that, which is what it was put there for, they're going to be held accountable. The state legislators are going to run straight to the media and say, don't send this guy back to Washington. Look at what he's spending money on. Because the states would have to pull it out of their treasury, you know, or tax the people directly themselves to raise their apportioned share of it. If you look at the original 12 amendments that were proposed, one of them said that Congress shall not impose a direct tax except when the monies coming from the impost and excise are insufficient for the public exigencies, nor then until Congress shall have first made a requisition on the states to assess and levy and pay their proportioned share. So there's your balanced budget amendment. I haven't seen any of the model balanced budget amendments that have come forth in the last 30 years read that way. Now, they say revenues and expenses and use all kind of ambiguous accounting terms that if they did pass one of these amendments that they're proposing, would just legalize that which is now completely prohibited by the Constitution. And these guys, you know, the average American citizen doesn't understand how these powers and things were interwoven into the Constitution. I wish they did. It'd be so nice, you know, because they could look at this balanced budget amendment that's been proposed and say, this is fraud codified. You know, we can't do this. But that's exactly what's in front of us. If they do propose a balanced budget amendment, and that's all they do, what are their odds of getting that right? Yeah, and you look at the other piece of this pie, it's mathematically impossible to balance a budget when every dollar is borrowed into circulation from a private bank. It's mathematically impossible. So have any of these folks who are talking about calling for a convention also said, we need to repeal the Federal Reserve and get back to silver and gold coinage in this nation? Because that's interest-free, and you know, we can do that, and there's no problem there. That's what made our nation great economically. And of course, the last vestige of it went away back in the 1960s.
Well, if a balanced budget isn't the solution, which we know it's not, it's all that does is maintain the status quo. If they balance budget, the fact of the matter is that what even when they had a budget 30 years ago, it was already far outside the chains of the Constitution. So to me, it would appear that the number one purpose of a constitutional convention would be able to remove some of those chains. Not that it's going to make a difference because they're ignoring the chains anyway, but the point is that it's simply going to empower a centralized government even more, is it not?
That's the only thing it could possibly achieve, unless we've got enough people around who understand. See, you know, we've got all these great quotes, you know, people like Daniel Webster. He said, "Hold on, my friends, to the Constitution. Miracles do not cluster. What has happened once in 6,000 years may never happen again. If the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world." Okay? Daniel Webster, you know, the guy who put the dictionaries together. He knew the definition of words. You know, this is important stuff. I got another quote, and this is my own. I want people to listen to this and see if this makes sense to you. "The framers of the Constitution, in a very real sense, may be thought to be like Sir Isaac Newton. Now, Newton is credited with being the father of physics, just like the Constitution's authors are considered the fathers of liberty and America. But Isaac Newton did no more to invent gravity than did our one and only Constitutional Convention's delegates invent liberty. What Newton did was observe the laws of nature and articulate them accurately so that they could be understood. What the Constitution's framers did was observe the laws of politics and articulate them accurately so that they could be understood. Read Newton, then read the Constitution. Newton's laws and the laws of our Constitution are parallels, each in their own sphere of jurisdiction. And if anybody thinks they're more skilled than the framers of the Constitution at making law to govern politicians, let them try to make a new law to govern the falling of an apple from a tree or the motion of the heavenly spheres. Such people would be equally successful at changing either for the benefit of mankind." That's my quote.
Well, let's look at this, some of the representations that are being made out there. One, you know, you heard statements like, well, there's been a dozen conventions of the states. And they're trying to, again, like they do so often, take a term and make it mean something else to suit their agenda, like calling this a convention of the states as opposed to a constitutional convention. So they're trying to say that, okay, there's been these meetings of the states before, so they stayed within the parameters of something. Why won't this? Can you elaborate on how that's a ruse?
Oh, I think we can throw that question to anybody on the panel, and they can give it a whirl. Who wants the Pastor Whitney, have you made it in yet?
We actually have a area code 540, a gal that's a former Sherman Institute student that wanted to ask a question. Would you like to take that question now?
Sure.
540, you have a live mic.
Hello, this is Anna Yisley.
Hello, Anna.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Alan, and hi, Sharon. So I don't want to call myself a former student. I consider myself a current student, but maybe not currently enrolled at the moment. So I wanted to change that.
Good to hear your voice again.
Thank
What's
you.
What's the question?
Hi, Anna. Well, I didn't hear the last question, so I can't really present an answer. But I heard, you know, was listening about the authority of this constitutional convention, and it seems that it is kind of within the Constitution's authority. You know, I was going to say, well, don't the people have the authority to do this? Shouldn't the people, the constitutionally restricted government, show we could do anything we want? But thing is, we don't want to do it. How do you stop it? and so I was going to suggest that if any politician who has voted for the Patriot Act, I would not want him on the or her on the committee to amend or anything other. So, but of course, that's already on a federal level, so I guess that wouldn't really work in terms of selecting your delegates.
Well, under the First Amendment, obviously, the people can have any assembly they want, but it doesn't. It's not a constitutional entity. A convention is an Article 5 event. It's an Article 5 body of people appointed by the rules of the Constitution on doing so. Congress calls it. Congress tells it where to go and when to be there, and then they become their own legal animal. So, we the people, Bob Schultz's group, had the event there in 2009. That wasn't an Article 5 convention. It was a group of people getting together to figure out what in the world we can do to fix some of our messes. We can do those kind of things all over the country anytime we want to, but we don't have the Article 5 authority to then submit our proposals back to somebody to ratify to become a whole new constitution. If we come
but
out
Aaron,
of that...
Yeah, the authority thing. Now, I thought all authority and power is derived from the consent of the people. So
well,
I have a hard time seeing how the government would have more authority than we, the people. You said that. Could you explain that?
The government does not have more authority than we, the people. But we, the people, have already given part of our authority to this Congress and to the state legislatures.
To rewrite our Constitution? I'm just being devil's advocate or whatever the, could anyone ever give authority to rewrite the Constitution if it's based upon natural principle? What we don't want is the fundamental principles to be rewritten. And I believe that is exactly what's going to happen. There's the Bill of Rights. They were already trampling all over the Bill of Rights. Well, how do we know what our rights are unless we have the Bill of Rights? So they're already trampling on it. Are the same people going to undo what they've done?
Here's the interesting part of this whole picture, and we haven't even touched this yet. Okay, let's just say that these folks do want an Article 5 convention, and they don't want to limit it to any one issue. So what is their agenda? Well, if you go back a few years, you'll find a guy by the name of Rexford G. Tugwell, who put together a book called The Emergent Constitution. And in there, with all of his globalist allies, is this draft new constitution. In addition to what it does, it creates a new branch of government called the planning branch. And it looks real similar to kind of the way things work right now. So most people who don't really get it with founding principles would look at this and say, well, yeah, we're kind of already operating like this. Why don't we just go ahead and adopt this Constitution? In it, the Bill of Rights look exactly like they do now. One little exception that the average person might not think too much about. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, except in a declared emergency. There's a clause there. The freedom of the press and all these other things shall not be abridged. Except in a declared emergency. And we've become so accustomed, to hearing, we got a, martial law in this country, and, every country has the power to declare emergencies and impose martial law if there's insurrection, rebellion, all this. Might as well give that stuff to Washington, too, and just put it in there. They're already doing it. What's the big deal? So this is what has been tried for years. The folks that are part of this internationalist clique that have talked about trying, they can't do it one amendment at a time because it's a whole new document. There's only one way they can implement this. Only one way. They need an Article 5 convention to do it. So will Rexford Tugwell's model be introduced as a possible project to come out of the Article 5 convention? I don't know. I don't want to make it even possible that it can be because I've read the thing and it's scary.
Well, it would violate the Virginia Constitution, for one thing, because I believe I did learn this in my class on the state government class with Aaron Bollinger, that we're looking at the Declaration of Rights, Article 1 of the Virginia Constitution. Section 1 says that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, of which when they enter into a state of society, this is the important part, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot, by any compact, deprive or divest their posterity, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and security. So not by any compact, not under any circumstance, can they deprive our posterity of the Bill of Rights, or living or unliving, born or unborn?
Well, that's as it stands right now. Now, if you go back and you read Madison's notes, there were some people in the convention that were actually talking about such things as completely dissolving the states and just forming them all into one national entity. Remember, their history was Europe, you know, and the whole notion of England, you know, the imperialism of England having all these little colonies out there, colonization, was a little bit foreign to them. They were kind of thinking, well, you know, we're on this side of the pond, they're on that side. Why don't we just have one nation over here, call it America? And, of course, a lot of the people there said, well, we can't dissolve our states. We weren't given the authority to do that. And they were saying back and forth, well, this is a convention. You know, we could do that, although probably it wouldn't pass, so let's not do it. But now this new convention convenes. We've got a whole new federal structure in place. A lot of people aren't even aware how this works, but it started about the time of Richard of Millhouse, you know, Richard Nixon. The states have already been divided up. The whole of America is now a new structural entity insofar as the federal government's concerned. There's 10 standard federal regions. Let's say this new constitution didn't recognize the states and said these new regions will be the new states, and we'll call it the new states constitution. And through that, we're going to administer all kind of grants. We're going to give all these people in these areas all kinds of money and stuff to make them go along with it. Now, is that so far-fetched? Because it's already happened. If you send in a tax return, you send in a document right now, you know, if you're in Federal Region 3, it goes to Federal Region 3. It doesn't go to your state or to, you know, a federal office in your state. You know, anybody who's up in the Northeast, all the tax returns go to Philadelphia because that's the capital of Federal Region 3. So they've basically redefined and redivided this whole thing up. If you work for a police department and you want a Justice Department grant to get a new urban assault vehicle through some Homeland Security project, the grant applications all go to, you know, the headquarters of your federal region, and that's who divides up all this money. So in reality, you know, our country has already been prepped for this type of an operation, for a new state's constitution. The dissolution of our states would be much simpler now than it would have been in the time of Mason. So even though the fundamental principle, and I agree with what you're saying, you know, that's why I said what I did. The founding fathers didn't create liberty. They articulated the laws of it. Now, you pass a new constitution, that doesn't change the laws of politicians or the laws that govern political science, but it certainly changes the rules of the game in whatever country you're in that's under that new constitution.
I can see how this is going to go down, Aaron. You know that they're going to – they need to push this through. They need to push this through to go any further.
Yeah.
So you know
they need to legalize what they're doing right now somehow.
Well, I see what's going to happen. Same thing happened Declaration of Independence, because what spurred the people was when King George started sending military onto our soil, right?
Right.
And isn't that what – that was one of the gracious – or what's the word, gracious faults of King George, that and he put military on our land. And so I can see how this is going to go down, and they're going to get this thing through, but I believe this is going to be the impetus to
I would suggest let's not invoke any biblical principles of calling things that be not as though they were. I'm still of the opinion that if enough people get woken up to what's happening around here, that we can actually, you know, stop it again. About every decade, this notion of coming up with a new constitutional convention comes roaring out of the woodwork, and in the last couple of times, we've been able to defeat it. And then,
there's a little pressure going on right now globally. There's the lawsuit, the British conservative, some British politician, conservative politician, told, you know, kind of warned George Bush, be careful about coming here to Britain.
The pressure is coming from the funding, because, you know, the people that are continuing to buy our debt are not going to want to continue to buy our debt. They're not going to want to keep funding our country for all of its political whims and things. So, you know, there has to be a mechanism in place to fix this thing.
Well,
go
I
ahead.
Mean, there's some pressure going on internationally because
this
is a long train of people who are in, you know, power.
The pressure,
all the time they're getting pressed. Thank you.
The pressure is almost from unlimited sources at this point in directions. This concept of a constitutional convention is just one of the angles that they're working. I mean, you look at the UN and Agenda 21, and you know, I can take you down to the endangered species and false science and, you know, the banking stuff that they're trying to, you know, really crash things to the point that the middle class, I mean, we could talk about this all day, but we're kind of getting off topic. So I kind of want to bring it back, if you will, Aaron. We were going to bring in Karen Roof and talk a little bit about those convention of the states and how that's a deception because there has been no unless somebody can correct me here, Karen, perhaps you can correct me. I'm not aware that there's been Article 5 constitutional convention since the Constitution was ratified initially. The organic one was. So they keep talking about like 1861. You know, they keep trying to make these appear as though they're something similar to a constitutional convention. And to me, it's a ruse. Can you talk about that?
There has not been any Article 5 convention since the creation of our own Constitution. As a matter of fact, and Aaron and possibly Dr. Vieira can speak to this as well, our founders indicated they were concerned that there could be one. I mean, they did not want another convention. And I have forgotten which one it was. It might have been Madison, but there was one of them that had spoken to that issue that, you know, another convention should be avoided if it could be, that it should only be as a last resort that there should be an Article 5 convention, and that's why they gave us the alternative of, you know, it's very easy to create amendments, and we still have to have, you know, a specific number of the states that have to ratify those amendments for them to become law. And supposedly, and that's an argument that I have heard, is that even if they have a convention, that it's possible that nothing would come of it because perhaps, you know, not enough states would then ratify it. Well, I don't think we can go by that either because the states at the time did not all ratify the Constitution at once. As a matter of fact, I think it was Rhode Island, wasn't it, Aaron? It was like 2 years before they finally followed suit and ratified it.
Well, yeah, and there were all kind of advertising campaigns. We see that broken snake all the time that has all the names of the states abbreviated in them and the join or die, you know, real hardball to get people to ratify the Constitution that they played. And, of course, you know, we see it at the state level all the time. There have been lots of state conventions, and if there's anything that we can learn from these state conventions, that once the power is given, it's not taken back. The next convention that comes along simply expands the powers a little bit further and gives the government you know, something new to work with. And it's usually under the pretext of some necessity, some money-spending thing that they have to have a new way to raise taxes or something because, you know, it just keeps ballooning out of control. You know, the people will ratify almost anything, and especially given the right circumstance. You have a big economic meltdown. You know, whoever promises two chickens in every pot is going to get elected, and if this new constitution is seen as the way to give the president the power, just like the Weimar Constitution in Germany. Adolf Hitler seized on that emergency power that was put in that Weimar. It looked otherwise like the American Constitution very much, but the power was there to give the president or the Führer, or, you know, the leader, translated, you know, executive powers that in an emergency, well, all you got to do is stub your toe and declare an emergency, and they kick in. And the public's not afraid of those things anymore like they used to be. You know, South Carolina recently ratified a constitutional amendment that allows the sitting members of the executive branch, police officers, the ability to sit in the legislature. Now, most people would say, yeah, cops are upright guys. That's fine. We'll pass that amendment. We'll let the police serve in the legislature. Well, that's a breakdown of the separation of powers. You don't give the power to enforce the law to the same person who has the power to write the law, or he's going to write new things to enforce to protect his job. Yeah, this is craziness. But the people pass this stuff left and right. So whatever comes out of a convention, now you got to look at the media. You know, Dr. Roof, you're the journalist here. What influence would the media have on getting people to ratify something bad?
Yeah, that's another issue right there, and I was thinking of that as you were talking, because a major problem that we did not have back when our founders created the original was that people today are grossly uninformed. Even those who weren't necessarily literate back in the, you know, the early days of our country knew what was going on. The average person was much more qualified to make a judgment call on something than people are today. And so all you would have to have is the clever media creating a few hope and change slogans and promising, you know, an extra benefit here and there. And since people don't even read the Constitution, even on Constitution Day in their classes anymore, they have no clue what it actually says, and so they don't know what they're giving up. So if you promise them some extra benefit and you create some clever, meaningless slogan to attach to it, you're going to have the masses badgering their state to go ahead and ratify it, and they won't know what they've got until it's too late.
Yeah, well, that brings us back full circle to what we're doing with Sherman Institute in trying to help recreate some of classic academia. And way off topic, I won't get into that. If Mr. Dodd, if you ever want to have us back on to talk about Sherman Institute, we'll do it. I don't want to do that right now. But this is a problem. People just don't know the skill with which this convention took place. You need to. In fact, if anybody emails me, I'll give my email address to the listeners. If you email me, I will give you the link. It's real easy to find. You can go on archive.org and download Madison's Notes of the Convention. Look what these guys did in that convention. Actually read it, because every article, section, and clause that was made, James Madison took copious notes on which state voted for which thing, and you know, how they structured the Great Compromise, and how they tied representation to direct taxes, what their hatred was of paper money, and why. You know, I got this little note card here. If you go, you know, download this book. It's called Formation of the Union, or Documents Illustrative of the Formation of the Union. This is actually a congressional document. It was ordered into print by Congress, and in their infinite wisdom, taken out of print. So now you have to find it, you know, in a PDF scan somewhere. But, you know, if you look at August 16th and August 28th, you'll find out how vigorous was the hatred for paper money. One of the delegates at the convention said that, you know, the power, of course, it was called something different back then. It was called bills of credit, okay? So they prohibited bills of credit in this new constitution that, you know, was drafted in 1787. One of the delegates said that leaving those three words in a power of Congress and emit bills, to emit bills of credit, which was originally proposed. They were originally going to allow Congress to have the power of paper money, or at least that was one of the proposals. But one of the delegates there said that those three words, if they were left in the Constitution, he would rather reject the whole plan of government than to leave Congress with the power to emit bills of credit. And another one said that those three words, if left to stand, would be as alarming as the mark of the beast. Okay? The hatred for paper money was just astonishing. Why? Because it's interest-bearing, it causes debt, and that's where we are now. It's not because the Constitution didn't prohibit it. It did. What we're lacking is enforcement of the provisions of the Constitution. If the people want to see a balanced budget, you need to stop endless borrowing, and you do that by having not paper money printed at U.S. notes, okay? That was Abe Lincoln's idea. What you have is, look at another pair of words. Congress has the power to coin money. Dr. Roof, you're a doctor of English. What is the word coin in that sentence?
It's a verb.
It's a verb. You can't coin paper, can you? If people just understood the English language when they read the Constitution, they would see that, wait a minute, you can't coin paper, and there's no power to print paper, is there? They have a power to coin money and regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin and fix the standard of weights and measures. Now, if you go to Deuteronomy, you'll see you should not have in your bag a diverse weight and measure. These guys understood long-standing biblical laws and laws of nature and laws of men, and they codified it into this Constitution. So giving Congress the power to fix the standard of weights and measures in the same sentence with the power to coin money marries those two phrases, doesn't it, from an English standpoint?
Indeed. Well, let's close out this talk about these conventions of states, because that's been a major point that these people like Rob Nadelson and others out there have been pushing, is that, we've had these conventions and all of these spheres are just unfounded. Yet, like 1861, for example, that was not an Article 5 convention called by the states. It was a convention called by the Congress for the delegates of the states to come together, not to write amendments or to rewrite or have the authority like a joint session of Congress, but only for the purpose of making recommendations to Congress to see if Congress is interested in doing or participating in those recommendations. So the representation that these convention of states equates to a constitutional convention is a misrepresentation, and it's blatantly deceiving the people when they put that out there. So,
yeah, the governor of Utah, what was his name, Nelson, I think, or there were two governors a few years ago back in the 90s that used that very language, conference of states. All that was just a slick attempt to avoid using the word convention, but their resolutions still called for a Article 5 type of event. I would question if a convention actually is called based on the languages of these resolutions and the legislators being deceived into thinking something is limited going on when it can't be limited. I would question the validity of even the call for the convention, because fraud, there's no statute of limitations on fraud, and if somebody is fraudulently convinced to do something to their detriment and they aren't aware that they're being defrauded into doing this, it's like in any other case, if you are tricked into doing something illegal, that's a defense. And I would see how anything that came out of a convention that was convened based on fraud could be considered valid. So there's another whole legal subject to be broached in one of these types of discussions. It has just major implications. I would say, Alan, are you still on the call? I got a question for you. According to your reading of Mason's Manual, which is a document used by about 70% of our states, what happens if bad faith or fraud causes a legislature to adopt or something, a piece of legislation, according to the rules?
It invalidates it.
It invalidates it. This is a rule in the rule books.
Yeah.
Now, is there any statute of limitations on fraud? No. So this is serious business. These people are really playing a game with our entire American veterans, that fought for this country. Yeah, they fought for America. They fought for this country. But they took an oath to the Constitution. America is nothing without her Constitution. It's just another piece of real estate, another banana republic on the map. So, you know, we've got to take those kind of things very, very seriously when we talk about something like an Article 5 event that can change or completely circumvent or replace the Constitution that makes America what it is.
Well, we've got another caller to come on. I'd like to introduce you guys to a good friend of mine who I spoke with you earlier about, Aaron, that I'd really like to get on to kind of a private conversation with you and Dr. Roof and others there regarding the boards of review. And Stephen Hance is one of the founders of the All States Organic Initiative and is the one that's been putting together some of the writs and the essays and orders for the boards of review. I'd like to welcome Steve back to Walls in Our Minds. Steve, you have a live mic.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's good to be here, as always. I have a question. I don't know if that's exactly a question, but I guess I could start with the question. If any of the speakers are familiar with the essay that I wrote regarding the construction of boards of review, is there a basis for conversation yet?
I have not. This is Aaron.
Okay.
He's about to get all of that. We talked about it today, Stephen.
Okay.
He's familiar with Article 61.
Right. Of Magna Carta. Most of what I've been hearing is like a perfect segue into a conversation about the implementation and the structure of boards of review and how they would solve the issues and the problems that that you've been discussing all around the panel this evening. So I won't get into that. I would like to say that. Go ahead, Terry.
I'd like to do a whole show on that. I know that Aaron wants to come back on and talk a little bit more about the Sherman Institute, and I thought we could kill two birds with one stone on that show. One, talk about Sherman Institute, but then get into the discussion of boards of review. But I thought it would be a good idea for us to have a conference before we do that show so that we can get everybody up to speed on it and get all the documents in their hands. So
sure.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, one thing, I don't want to be a hair splitter, but I am. I've heard several times from different ones speaking in reference to the history or certain events in the formation of our country. And I would like to respectfully suggest that the fact that that terminology is used so freely among people like yourselves indicates perhaps a foundational issue with the whole subject matter that you've been approaching. Every time I hear that phrase, our country or this country, I want to stop the speaker and say, excuse me, what country is it that you're talking about? And, of course, the obvious retort is, well, the United States. But I would respectfully suggest that you need to study the meaning of the terms. And if you do, I think you'll understand eventually my point. It's not just to be argumentative. The United States is not a country. The United States has never been a country. It never will be a country unless, of course, they have that constitutional convention and turn it into a national form of government. As it stands now, the United States is no more a country than Europe or the European Union. The United States is a federation formed ostensibly in order to create a more perfect union out of the original Confederation of 1781. The very problem that we face in all of the arguments about and even Supreme Court cases that argue about the constitutionality of this and the constitutionality of that. And the fact of the matter is, the NDAA is not unconstitutional. It is within the realm of the Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 17 and 18 authority given to the U.S. Congress to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, as long as it's restricted to that district and other needful buildings or territories and whatnot. The federal zone operates and functions, especially since the Organic Act of 1871, as a national form of government. That's the only place and the only confines in which it does operate as a national government. When it's operating under the enumerated powers, it's a federal government with extremely limited powers and authority. The U.S. Congress exercises lawfully exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever within the federal zone. And if you read the...
Stephen, I just wanted to try to help you pull it together here, because I know, I recognize that you're not off topic, but some people may perceive that you're off topic. Let me say, make a comment and see whether or not you agree with that this is what's going on. You're talking about jurisdictions, and you're talking about the fact that this federal government, which really is, as Aaron pointed out earlier, is not like the organic government that was established by the Constitution originally. They've completely changed it to a usurpation, to a counterfeit. Some people talk about de factos versus de jures. That all works. It applies. But the fact of the matter is that they have created all these usurpations and have dumbed down the people to believe that they have jurisdiction in these 10 zones that Aaron talked about a while ago, Federal Zone 3, whatever, when in fact those are not within their jurisdiction at all. And what they want to do with this constitutional convention is to make it so that they can actually codify and change it so that they do have that jurisdiction. What we're dealing with here in this constitutional convention is an effort to completely change the jurisdiction of that federal government. That's exactly what they're trying to do.
Their resolution calling for a convention actually uses that term. It says to limit, which is vague, the power and jurisdiction of the federal government. Now, that can be taken all kind of different ways. So obviously they're opening things up. And I do understand what you're saying. If you look at a law and you see the word United States in that law, it may not mean the 50 states. It may mean the federal district and Puerto Rico and all federal territories, Virgin Islands, things like that. And, of course, that's something that many people in the tax movement are familiar with. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I know what you're saying. It's hard to say it in a truncated form and explain it to people so they really get what's going on there. But I know what you're talking about, sir.
Can we kind of switch the thinking for a minute? Because I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes talking a little bit about solutions. We know that the Article 5 Convention is not going to solve our problems. It's going to create more problems and take more rights away and simply centralize power even more. I think we're all in agreement on that, are we not?
That's, as far as I can see from everything that's ever come down the pike, that's what a convention will try to do.
Okay, so what is a solution? What do we need to do to fix the problem? And And that, again, we're going to spend a show on this, so I'm not looking to try to solve the whole thing in 10 minutes, but I'd like to at least give the people a taste of what maybe some of those solutions are, and maybe give each one of you 2 minutes. Stephen, why don't you take 2 minutes and give yours, and then we'll let Aaron go and Karen go and whoever else wants to jump in then.
All right. The solution that appears to me is to create a board of review for every state and ultimately for every county in every state whose purpose is not to alter or abolish anything pertinent to the government structure itself, but to restore the government to absolute obedience to the limitations of the Constitution that created the republics, both of the states and of the federal republic. They would spring sua sponte from the authority, the inherent authority of the people to do so. And that's probably about as far as I can go with within the parameters set forth.
Thank you, Stephen. Hang in there. I don't want to mute you out. I just want to try to get everybody in here. Let's go to Karen for a minute, because I'm going to qualify the question when I come back to Aaron and give him the final word on this. But Karen, what do you see as a solution? And you might want to comment on what Stephen said.
I agree with him. And John Rollin, another fellow who was with us at the Continental Congress, had the same idea. I think he calls them something different, but it's a review committee of some sort. I can't remember exactly what or it was at the moment. A review commission, that's what it was. Federal Action Review Commission. Mm-hmm. And at the Continental Congress, one of the things that Bob Scholes was, where he was actually headed, his agenda was to establish constitutional lobby in every state with membership and with a paid lawyer and so forth, who would actually review every piece of legislation that was brought forward, that was, you know, created, both for on the state level and on the federal level, so that people would look at legislation before it was, you know, passed into law and say, no, you can't do this. This is a violation of the Constitution, and sort of stop it in its tracks. Now, we're supposed to have a mechanism already that does that, but it isn't working. And so, you know, John had said that we would have to do it kind of gradually and work on the least egregious things in order, and then as people caught on that we actually could make changes that would work. And I think that might be a good way to go. In the front end, we've got to do two things. We've got to make a much greater effort to educate our voters and then to also elect people that have a reputation for doing everything they can to abide by the Constitution. And then I do think it wouldn't be a bad idea to have some amendments. One thing I would like to see happen is to repeal the 17th Amendment and put the senators directly back in as being responsible to the state, because if they're not representing the state, they're representing their lobbyists and their fundraisers. And if the senators were accountable to the state for how they spent money or who they approved or, you know, so forth, that accountability is completely missing in Washington. So we establish some accountability, establish, you know, a constitutional lobby or a review board, and then, you know, make a point of electing constitutional, you know, legislators. I think those are the directions we've got to start going.
Stephen, I'm going to give you 1 minute to qualify what Karen just said, because I know that there were some things in there that probably leaped out at you regarding the fact that we're not going to be working through the existing courts or anything like that, but we're rather exercising natural rights and common law. And that's going to set Aaron up for the last 3 or 4 minutes to close us out, I believe. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, I have to plead nolo contendere. I was distracted and had to step away from the phone until just...
That's okay. That's okay.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make the point that all of these remedies that people have been seeking, like Schultz and others, they're trying to seek remedy through these courts, and these courts are no longer serving the people. They're no longer public servants. They don't operate and don't even allow common law to enter in unless you can go in pro persona under Seventh Amendment or whatever and try to set a common law court. And basically what usually happens is that it gets dismissed, or the judge abandons the court, or they try to, you know, figure out some other way to get the person into some kind of a contract so they can throw them in jail. But there will be no remedy in these courts. It's impossible, because all they are they work for the banks. They don't work for the people. They're basically working for the mercantilist. They're commercial courts. They're admiralty courts. There is no common law allowed there unless you force the issue on them, and you're not going to get remedy for the people in general that way, because the people in general don't know how to defend themselves in that way.
Right.
So, Aaron, you got...
That's what the boards of review are for. That's bringing common law to bear directly on the government officers. And that's all I'll say. Let you go on.
Well, Aaron, in addition to what I've just thrown at you to do and to solve in 3 minutes, we did have a question from our friend Jan, who says, what happens to the state constitutions if a CONCON does bring forth a new constitution?
That all depends on the wording of whatever comes out of the convention, because just as we've shown before, there was talk of dissolving the states entirely and putting them under a major national form of government. The problem was, and they recognized it at the time, that the impetus wasn't there, the people would never go for it. At this point, you know, you may have some loyalty to your state, but most people consider the state's administrative arms of the federal government at best anyway. So the situation has changed dramatically over the intervening period of time. And to get back to your, you know, resounding end question, what can we do? Well, first thing we got to do, and this is what Sherman Institute's all about, we got to educate people. The week of December 2nd, we start our new semester. Courses on parliamentary procedure, on state government, that, you know, we're teaching what no modern school dares teach who takes federal grants and loans and all the things that go into that whole accreditation and otherwise program. So if you really want to study Madison's notes, you know, you want to study your state constitution from its founding up through, this is probably the one place that patriots can go to find higher education that actually cares. And we're probably the most politically incorrect school on the planet. Good. I want to keep it that way. And if you have an interest in state activism and learning what these rules, every year people get bills stuck in committee. They don't know what to do. You know, the rules of procedure give you all kinds of options, but you got to know the rule books. Most people don't, you know, I say we use the Mason's Manual. What's that? Well, what do the Freemasons have to do with politics? It has nothing to do with Freemasons. Paul Mason was the Thomas Jefferson of recent times, and he studied parliamentary procedure, and he created a new handbook that now 70% of our states use instead of the Jefferson's Manual. But if you don't know the Mason's Manual, how are you going to win? You know, how are you going to get anything through? So, you know, that's what we're here for, to teach those aspects of higher education that people ought to know. In addition, we're teaching a great book-style program. You know, you'll study Aristotle and Plato and the great statesmen. You read the Federalist Papers. You take a course with Dr. Roof, and you learn sentence analytics, how to tear these sentences apart and figure out what they really mean. You know, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 is not an elastic clause.
I'm afraid we're out of time, and I do want to plan another show. So I just want to say thank you to everyone for participating tonight. This has been a great show, and I think with a little bit of conferencing, we can really offer some solutions together and get our heads together outside of this venue and plan that. Thank you, Karen, for having us.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's been wonderful. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Sharon. You didn't get to say much later on, but you contributed early. Thank you. And Ellen, too. I think it was Ellen that called in. And Keith, sorry we didn't get back to you, but another time. So thank you, everyone, and good night. See you next week on Walls in Our Minds.